Hello and welcome to the very 299th episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, the podcast all about board games and the people who love board games. I am a person who loves board games and I'm joined by another one. It's Tom Brewster.
Where are the... Oh, it's me. Yay!
It's you. You're sitting right there. You're you.
And I'm playing a board game right now.
Are you?
I'm playing Dominion on my phone.
Stop playing on your phone and you're doing the podcast.
That would be just having little Dominion words slowly worming their way into my podcast chat. Yeah, so the market, the blacksmith, the workshop, and I'm sort of like decaying as I'm trying to talk to you because I'm trying to keep my eyes on the Dominion game.
Yeah.
It'd be pretty good. I ran out of Dominion cards that I remembered.
I was going to say, like, they're quite generic.
They are quite generic, yeah. Like, I wish there was more specific words I could probably use.
Yeah, I think if you were doing, like, Star Realms, then I might clock it.
Yeah.
I might
but
be
Dominion,
like,
I could probably, like, stealth mention every card in Dominion in a regular board game podcast.
Yeah, and I'd be like, he's into blacksmithery. That checks for a man who lives in this part of England.
The fact that you could probably mention every individual Dominion card name in a podcast, I think is an indictment on the board gaming hobby as a whole. And the kinds of themes it springs for.
Start putting card names in games that are outrageous, you cowards. I want to see names of card that I cannot say publicly without being...
Detained
or demolished or exiled.
As you can probably tell from this slightly peculiar intro, me and Matt are still in the slightly ludicrous, slumbery stage of post-Board Games Direct nonsense.
Yes, we're coming out of our like homeostasis, maybe, or a little, what's the word? Hibernation.
Like a bear that's been woken up from hibernation, but with a large plank of wood to the head.
Yes.
That's kind of how I feel right now.
Yes.
It's going great. I've got all these games swimming around in my head. I learned a lot of games for
you
Board Games Direct. And so putting a few more into it for this podcast is going to be a real challenge.
Like, honestly, you know, you did the devil's work.
I did.
That's not the devil.
I made a pact with the devil.
What's the word when it's like you did the most of the work?
The lion's share.
The lion's share.
The devil's share.
You did the lion's share of learning the games. And I do feel like thinking about it, sitting someone in a room being like, now you need to learn how to play 60 board games.
Yeah.
That seems like the sort of thing you'd see in a sci-fi series where they're making kids do it before they give them psychic powers.
I did like 12 a day for 5 days. Yeah, it was really funny.
I'm just imagining you with a shaved head and like like nodes all over your head and like brain scans on a wall.
My eyes roll back into my skull and I perfectly recite all of the rules to Siberian Manhunt.
Yeah, and then you can also like use psychic powers to throw things and
That's
stuff.
True. I wish I had psychic powers.
Well, maybe if we do another Board Games Direct next year, you'll develop psychic powers.
Quite possibly. On this podcast, we're just going to talk about a couple little games. It's a little short, snappy, snippy little pod that we're just going to throw out there into the world.
Like an alligator with a pair of scissors.
Yes. We're going to talk about Emberheart, a game of dragons, capturing them, nurturing them, maybe making them fight. You don't do that. You don't do that at all.
It's like, is that a Pokemon?
I led with capturing. You're actually sort of freeing them from poachers, I think, is the main part of that game.
Are you going to give them a little kiss?
I made Emberheart sound really hardcore just then. It's actually quite gentle.
Okay.
And then we're going to talk about Sushi Go Party, presumably a party version of the hit game Sushi Go.
No, it's Sushi, Go Party.
It's a command.
It's an instruction for fish and or rice. That really tickled you there. I got a very genuine little chuckle.
Really
there. I enjoyed
it's
that.
Really
Thank
good.
You.
I just enjoyed it a lot. And at the end of this podcast, we're going to have a little bit of a chat about Eternal Sevens. Maybe because it's quite hard to get.
Yep.
And I have pretty mixed feelings about it.
Mm.
Just a little teaser for the pod aficionados later on. Let's podcast! Just adding in a very minor correction here. We incorrectly called Sushi Go Chef's Special Sushi Go Party. It's a lot less fun to say, but it's actually called Chef's Special, and we're going to talk about that game instead. Because Sushi Go Party came out in 2016 and we already reviewed it. First up on this podcast, I want to tell you, Matt, about Emberheart.
Me? Little old me?
Little old you.
This is the game where you chase and kiss dragons, right?
You do.
Yeah.
Correct. 10 points for you, the attentive podcast listener. This is designed by Rob Fisher and Adam Porter, with art by Andrew Bosley and published by Mind Clash Games. And we quite like Mind Clash Games here at Shut Up and Sit Down.
Yeah.
Covered a bunch of their stuff in the past.
Yeah.
But this is part of the Mind Clash Play line of games, which I find very funny as a distinction.
Yeah, this is basically like, we're not going to completely demolish your brain.
Yes.
Like,
I'm not going to turn it into paste.
Because I feel like Mind Clash, like, you know what you're getting. Like,
yeah,
Mind Clash is a nice way of saying, this game's going to kind of hit you in the head with a hammer.
Right.
And like, I like that.
Yeah.
But my gosh, they really hit you with those hammers.
I love that like this is the Mind Clash play line, implying that you're not playing any of the other games. Like the other games, that's not play, that's something entirely different.
I like the idea that they're making them like, these ones are for toddlers, these ones are for babies. Yeah. These ones are for like tiny children.
It's and quite like complicated Euro game.
A normal human is like, this is enough. This is complicated enough, please. Please let the psychic boy who's reading all the manuals play it. He's smart. I can't do this.
So this is a game in which you are rescuing dragons. And the core of it is kind of a bit of a mixture of worker placement and bidding. There's a whole bunch of these different spaces on the board. And if you want to visit them, you're going to have to send one of your little worker discs to that place. And you're going to have to accompany that disc with some workers that kind of sit underneath it. Almost like a little stack of poker chips. But the top one's a poker chip. The bottom ones are just cardboard.
Okay.
And depending on how many workers you put under that disc, you can visit different spaces at each location. So there's a space for 5, space for 4, space for 3, space for 2, space for 1. And you can send it to any one of those spaces, and you get exactly the same effect, no matter where you send it.
Right.
But you get priority in what you choose from the place.
I see.
So if you send 5 workers, and you put your little disc on top, and you send it over there, and you go to the 5 spot, you're going to get first dibs.
You spent a lot of discs.
Spent a lot of
to
discs.
To go to this dragon shop.
Exactly. So if you send your big stack of 5 workers with a little disc on top to the, you know, terrain space, to the preserve, the reserves.
You're guaranteed to get some primo earth.
You're getting first dibs on those habitats for your dragons.
Mm-hmm. You get to the fish market at 6 a.m. and you're picking those prawns before anyone else is even seeing the prawns.
You got your mitts all over those prawns.
But at what cost? Because like, I'd happily just put one worker in and I'll get whatever prawns I get.
Yeah, you'll get leftover workers. Well, there's a lot of reasons that you want specific things on the board. So the way that these resolve is kind of in a clockwise fashion. Once everyone's placed out all of their workers for the round, you resolve each area in a kind of circle. And I guess that makes sense for me to just explain each of those little areas.
Yeah, why not?
At the bottom, you have heroes. And heroes will give you a little special ability and an endgame scoring condition, but only if you attach them to the correct color of dragon.
Right.
So you'll get a red hero, so now you need a red dragon. Well, where do you get the red dragons? You're going to get them up at the top of the board. Well, there's 2 ways of doing it. The first one is you can go and get the dragons back off the dragon poachers. And there's a little market of 3 dragons available.
Right.
But there are 5 spaces that you can place workers on. And so only 3 people are going to get those little dragons, and maybe you're going to get left out.
Right.
Which is nasty. And so those dragons will have a color associated with them, and you can, you know, pluck them away and you can put them into your little player area. But what if you want more choice? You can go up Dragon Mountain, which has higher point value dragons because all of them have a certain amount of points. It has a wider variety of dragons because there's more of them on there, but it involves a little bit of danger.
Yeah.
Because there's kind of 3 levels to Dragon Mountain. There's a bottom level that has 3 dragons available, and you can just grab one of them, just like the other.
I mean, I feel like if you know, just to, yeah, I feel like if it was just easy to go and grab a dragon
from Dragon Mountain,
then there wouldn't be much money in poaching.
Absolutely. Good point. But then the thing that's interesting is that once you've gotten your first dragon, you can ascend the next layer of Dragon Mountain, but only if one of your workers gets burnt to a crisp.
Oh.
Pretty exciting, right?
Everything has a cost.
And then when you get to the very top, you can have to burn 2 workers.
That's just dragon capitalism, all right, Tom? If you don't like it, then just what are you going to do? Dragon communisms?
Yes.
Actually, dragon communism sounds sick.
Sounds really good.
Sign me up.
And then lower down the board, you have these reserves that you can get, which are kind of like places for your dragons to hang out. And that means you can either attach a dragon to a hero, like I described earlier, to unlock that end game bonus and little scoring thing and the ability they have, or you can attach them to a reserve, which will improve your dragon attributes.
Oh,
because on your personal player board you have 3 little sliders that you can sort of like fade up like a sort of
like
dragon
a dragon DJ,
DJ
yeah,
draconic DJ.
Ooh.
And these will give you little bonuses to your dragon meeple. That's right.
Ooh.
Every player gets their own personal dragon.
Well, I good. Now, I want to assume here in this situation that these little dragon DJ sliders represent top Trump style dragon stats such as fire,
yes,
scales, and
wings. Correct.
Did I get it?
I think that's pretty much bang on.
Well done, they got it right.
And they will all sort of imbue your little dragon meeple with those abilities, which you can put on any stack that you put out onto the board. You can also send your little dragon worker along with it, which will do things like let you pretend that that stack has a couple extra workers in it, for
example. Just makes that stack of workers
better.
They
just make that stack a little
bit. So you can send a dragon off to go and steal more dragons.
Yeah.
Scab.
That's good.
I don't even have a response. To space.
There's a couple of other extra spaces that are available. There's like a tavern you can go to get more of these worker discs. Mm-hmm. Or there's a place you can go to sort of use the dragons to fight against some people who are invading or something like that.
Right, sure.
Which are kind of like it's a kind of contract, basically. They'll give you a big bunch of points. But that's all there is to it, really. It's like quite simple, straightforward game of like placing out these little stacks of workers, trying to get the thing that you want before anyone else does. And I really, really quite liked it.
Oh, cool.
It reminded me a lot of a game we played recently called Luthia, which I covered on the channel, which was similarly a sort of quite crunchy game of sending out these little stacks of workers to places, trying to get priority. But that was a hidden bidding system.
Mm.
And also the game had all of this extra stuff ornamented around that core. And I love how much Emberheart just gets into the grit immediately. Yeah. It's just like, this is the system that we're going to explore, and we're going to explore it really thoroughly, but we're going to keep it like simple.
Got it.
And it just works really nice.
I got a lot of time for that. Like, I think that, like, I must say that bidding for actions, like in a Euro game, I think I've been burnt by that. But I think if it's open information, I'm cool with it. It's the hidden information for me is too much.
Yes.
At that point, it's like, I don't want to crunch and not know.
Yeah, especially in a game where like the stuff that you're crunching for then kind of leads to even more crunch. It's like you're trying to run this very complex engine and you need certain things to go your way. Having blind bidding on top of that can often be a little too much for my little brain.
Yeah.
And I like how much Emberheart just says, you know, you can read people's intent a lot more clearly. And the actual engine that you're running on the other side of it isn't so complex that if something goes wrong, it's the end of the world. There'll be other ways to get it.
Got it.
There's also some lovely little extra systems in here. Like you can specialize your workers. You can turn them from the regular gray discs into like fancy discs, which means that they'll come back to you at the end of the round, but they can only be sent to certain spaces.
Oh,
so you're
specialized.
Kind of in danger of over-specializing, which is quite nice, and you kind of want some grey workers back. And there's also this thing which is, instead of placing out your little stacks of workers onto the board, you can claim these sort of special shields that will give you a one-use ability. And when all of those shields are gone, that's when the round ends.
Hmm.
So if you're particularly mean and savvy, you can kind of rush those before anyone actually gets a chance to place out all their stuff in any given round. There's a lot to really like. I was really pleasantly surprised by this one, and I honestly think that like this Mind Clash play range, the games that they're putting out that are like sort of show off a similar design pedigree but without swamping you with a million rules,
yes,
I think are actually really quite sharp and might be some of my favorites of theirs.
Class.
I think Ironwood was in that series as well.
Yep.
And that was a banger.
And that was great.
This one's a little bit of a banger as well.
It's
Emberheart.
Next we have Sushi, comma, Go Party, full stop, Chef Special.
No,
question mark? Chef Special? Sushi Go Party, Chef's Special. This is one of the games that was covered as part of our Board Games Direct series very recently.
Mm-hmm.
So you should know that we were paid money to do some stuff regarding this game, and therefore any opinions we have on this game, you take them however you like.
Take them with a big pinch of salt if you wish.
Like I like to think that
or a nice little twist of sugar.
Maybe a little spliggle of vanilla.
Yeah.
Just as a treat.
Take these opinions however you choose to have them.
I like to believe that I'm not going to be influenced by that in terms of my opinions on games. But you know what? The human brain is strange. You make your own judgments. Pinch of salt administered. This is designed by Phil Walker Harding, the Baron Park boy, as I like to think of him in my head.
Yeah.
I probably shouldn't say that outside of my head. Apologies.
Apologies to Phil.
Apologies to Phil and anyone else who just didn't like that. And this is published by Game Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I got a bit of a confession in the fact that, for me, Sushi Go is the Super Mario 2 of board games.
Explain yourself.
Well, Super Mario 2 was a version...
Sort of the Sushi Go of video games.
Yeah, for me, it really is. Because Super Mario 2 is a game that's like looks like a normal Super Mario game, but actually you go around and you pick up vegetables and you can throw things and it's kind of weird. And
okay.
It was included in so many bundles in my growing up years.
Right.
I think I owned Super Mario 2 on various different consoles.
Okay.
I owned various copies.
Yes.
And I never really played it much because I didn't want to. Sushi Go, I've owned maybe 3 or 4 times in different iterations. The original, Sushi Go Party in the tin, other versions. I've never played it.
Wow.
It sat with me.
So you've had it but not played it?
I've had it. Oh. It's sat there. I haven't got around to it.
That's
and then a time has come where I've been like, oh, this would be good for, you can have this. And I've just given it to somebody because they need a game. And I'm like,
they need a game stat.
For what I'm aware of, this sounds like it'll be perfect.
Uh-huh.
And people come back to me and say, that was great. And I'm like, cool.
And that is kind of the niche that it's occupied in this hobby for a long time, I think. It's kind of described as this sort of very universally loved little entryway game that anyone can pick up and play.
It's cute. It's simple. Children can learn it. The sushi's got little faces and they're really cute and nice. And honestly, Playing it for the first time, I get it. Great little game. Great little game. And this is a great big game. It comes in a box, right? It's not just a little tiny tin that you can pop in your pocket. This is a box.
Let me see if I can recall what I remember of Sushi Go. I think it's very simple. You basically just get a hand of cards that have sushi on them.
Yep.
And then you draft them. And that's the entire game?
That's right? The game. That's
and
the
they
game.
All have slightly different scoring criteria and you're trying to make nice little sets. If you haven't played Sushi Go, that's basically how it works.
Yeah. You just basically get a hand of cards, you pass them around, you keep one each time and you place them into your tableau in front of you, and then once you've passed all the cards, you just look at what you've got and you score.
Great. And then you do that a few times if you fancy.
That's it. You do it a few times.
And then Sushi Go Party just added more sushi, right?
Exactly. More sushi, fewer problems. Like that's just that's what I always say. But Sushi Go Party Chef Special is a new standalone version, and it has basically
a chef.
Some interesting stuff in it. Like
a chef in the
box. It feels like it's been like 10 years since Sushi Go Party.
Acknowledge that there's a chef in the box.
There isn't a chef in a box. I'm really sorry. There is a strawberry shortbread dessert.
What the hell are we doing
which
here?
Is a little cardboard first player token that's kind of like holographic shiny and is very cute.
And it's very sweet.
Very cute. Now, this adds like a bunch of new cards and a bunch of new systems and stuff. And it's backwards compatible. And it's set up to be like, the reason it takes up a whole box is it has that kind of like, and I don't know why, the only thing I can think of is Arctic Scavengers. Such a bizarre deep cut.
Yeah, Arctic Scavengers Chef Special was wicked.
It has that kind of like set up. So there's like a little neat place for all the cards.
Oh, right. Okay.
So you can just grab the bits you want.
Yeah, and it's like modular. A Dominion or sort of like, you know, those sort of standard deck builders where there's like a big pile of like,
exactly.
There are 15 market cards and they have a little channel for them to sit in.
Exactly. So you'd be like, here are all this type of sushi cards, here's these, and it means the idea is you can mix it up and play with different sushis each time.
Yes.
So far so sushi. That's the same as Sushi Go Party, right? What's different about this one though is the fact that you have like these different menu boards, which means that the actual setup for the game is different.
Okay.
So it means that like, yes, you've got your sashimi cards and you've also got desserts and you've got rice dishes and those means you have one of these, two of these, and then one of those, and that's the card pool.
That's the menu.
But the menus are different. So some of the boards will be like, there are two desserts in this game, or there are two rice dishes, which really does kind of mix up the game quite a lot in terms of how this scoring and hand building stuff works. So there's a little bit of cleverness there in terms of like, oh, they've actually like made this a game that has more of a replay value than the original versions did. Because it means like, even if you've played all the mix and match of the originals, gets to a point where you kind of understand the shape of the game.
Yeah.
Everyone understands a meta of like what's more valuable to keep, etc. This just adds an element of like unknown to it. And having all these little boards, you can just flip out and choose one randomly and be like, there are two desserts in the next round. This
and a
game.
Nice bit of direction as well, I guess. If you have all of these different kind of cards, it could be quite daunting being like, well, what do we include? I don't know how I'm going to craft my own Sushi Go experience.
Yeah.
Having the little set menu probably means it's a nicely
sculpted. Well, they're not set menus. They're just like different distributions.
Oh.
So like the rice items will have like a scoring system that's always similar. They'll be like, they always do something like this. And then you'll have a card that will be like, I think the ginger card, little cute piece of pickled ginger. That means like it will double the values on the next rice type card played.
Right.
But then the rice card in that game might be, there's like five different types of rice
of possible
dish.
Rice it could be.
So you've got a lot of malleability in terms each game being like slightly different, while some of the more traditional dishes are just always the same.
Right.
If you use them. I just found a couple of the little ideas in here really delightful. One of the cards was just really good for points, but if you played it, then it meant the next card you draft, you don't get to look at. You just have to take the deck, pull one out randomly and put it in front
of
you.
That's very fun.
Very delightful. Mm. And also a fun bit of strategy when like, you know roughly what is in the next setup. You're
potentially a real cruncher.
Right? So there's little stuff there that is like, for kids, it was just light and fun and a bit wild. Like, oh, do I do that crazy risky thing?
Right.
But as an adult, you're like, I'm playing the numbers game on this one.
I'm counting
and I know what
sushi
I'm doing.
Cards.
But I thought it was a really nice production, and the fact that it was all like kind of reverse engineered, it felt like something where like, hey, if you really enjoyed Sushi Go and you kind of wanted like a big box collection with some new features and stuff, I was like, if you're Sushi Go heads, this seems like a really great, well thought out like collection of stuff.
Yeah.
But the reason that I was like, oh, this is cool.
Okay.
Was one of the types of cards is a dessert and it was like an ice cream sundae.
Yes.
And I read the rule for how it worked and I didn't quite understand it. But I was like, whatever, fine, we'll play. And then I realized at the end there was something odd about the card. It was like reflective. You know how sometimes you see a spot gloss on the card?
Yeah.
It was like an inverse spot gloss where I was like, there was a patch on the card that was matte and dull.
Okay.
In the shape of like a raspberry. And I was like, why is that like that? And I investigated it and I realized that one of the desserts you can have in the game has a heat sensitive like print on it.
What?
Which means that the system is that when you get it and you play it in front of you, you press your thumb onto it and it reveals a number on the card. Uh-huh. You put it face up so that everyone can see how many points that's worth, but then it fades. So literally it's like, you don't have to flip the card over to hide the information. It's just like you hold, heat it up. People can see, oh, that's worth 3 points.
Right.
But then like within a few seconds, it fades back to being opaque. And then it means no one can see how many points it's worth until the end of the game.
Oh, a little memory challenge.
And like, you know, it's no different from having it face down.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's very different. And having these cute little ice creams that when you get the cards, you're like putting your thumb over them.
Yeah, that's very
cute. To like look at the like thing. And yeah. Again, there was room for bluffing there because you could get your hand of cards at the start and be like, oh, and like pretend you're like prodding and heating up cards that have nothing on them.
That's great.
But I don't know, I just thought as a piece of like engineering, as
yeah, as like a weird, I was like, component,
there was one of the cards in it, I think used the dice, we didn't use them, but mm-hmm. like it's just like a kind of randomized thing, but
that's super sweet.
And that's it. And I feel like Sushi Go, like a lot of people love having it as their like to-go game where it's a yeah. little tiny thing you can carry around, and
like
I just
an
think
dinner game or something,
and
right?
I just think this was a very nice like kind of stay-at-home version almost, sure, of being, like, yeah, it has some more stuff. There was a lot of love put into it, and like it was stuff like that, little details there that I just thought, oh, this is cool. Fair play.
That sounds really sweet.
Yeah, I just thought the heat sensitive raspberries were pretty neat.
They put them in every board game.
Yeah, right.
Finally, on this podcast, I want to have a very brief chat about Eternal Sevens.
I'll allow it.
This is designed by Hiroken and published by Trick Takers Games, and is quite hard to get. Hence, I'm keeping it to like a little limited snapshot. It seems that the way that you get this game at the moment is by filling out a form on BoardGameGeek.
Yes.
In the threads. Crazy.
Yeah.
What a world.
Yeah, it feels akin to like, I've got a mate who can get you the Matrix on DVD, yeah, exactly, but you have to meet them behind the chippy at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, it's a slightly black market vibe. Yeah,
it does. I don't think it is a black market purchase, but they've certainly hidden
has
it a little
the trappings
bit.
Of one, right?
Yeah.
This is kind of a bit of a follow-up or sort of spiritual sequel to Eternal Dex, a game that we didn't do a video of, but I talked about on our sort of best games of whatever year it came out in list a while back. And this is a follow-up, but it is a competitive game rather than Eternal Dex's cooperative game.
I think Eternal Dex is a game that people only really start to get their hands on the past like 3 or 4 months, really.
Yeah,
like,
it was quite late. I think we got quite an early scoop on it.
I think we
and
did.
And again, I think I've got quite an early scoop on this one as well. Thank you again to Mr. Ben from Travel Games for hooking me up with these unusual delights.
But it's very nice because I've seen people playing Eternal Dex out in the wild because of the stuff we talked about originally, and people having loving it. People having a great time.
Yeah, I think it's really special. And Eternal Sevens is a little bit of a tricksy follow-up because it's a competitive game and it's based off of Sevens, where essentially what you are going to do with your hand of cards is you must play them out onto the center of the table. You must start with either a 4, a 5, 6, or a 7 versus Sevens, where you just have to play a 7.
Mm-hmm.
And then you build those rows out on either end. So if I've got a 6, I can play a 5 or I can play a 7. And then you can build it out as long as you have a card that is adjacent to one of the numbers that's currently shown on the table.
Okay.
But then once you get...
So it's like double-ended solitaire.
It's like double-ended solitaire. The thing is, once you get all the way up to 10 or all the way down to 1, the last space on the table for a card has like an infinity symbol.
You can only
play these purple infinity cards on the ends of the rows. And as soon as you do that, mm-hmm. something kind of weird happens. You take one of these star tokens and you put it in the space that is next to the other end.
Right.
So let's say we had...
You can't complete both ends. You complete an end and then you put a star on the other end.
Yes. If we had 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and then, yep. and then we get to the 10, we put the infinity, then the star would go on the 3. And now you have to build the row from the other end. So you have to place the infinity card, then the 1, then the 2, then the 3 must be the last card placed.
To make 2 little arms to reach in the middle.
Exactly. And it forms like a sort of a loop. And if you get to place that card, if you place that 3, you get the little star token, 2 star tokens, and you win the game.
Got it.
Or if you get rid of all of your cards, you win the game as well. Those are the 2 ways of it happening. And there's also something slightly juicy in what happens when you choose to pass. Sometimes you might not be able to play, or maybe you just don't want to play.
Uh-huh.
You can choose to pass. And one of the pass options is you pass and you discard a card from your hand.
Mm-hmm.
Nice and simple. One of the pass options is you pass and you get a rare card into your hand, which is a wild card you can play wherever you want. But the third option for passing is the weirdest one, which is when you pass with the third option, you put an eternal into play, a continuous eternal, which changes the rules of the game in like a subtle way. So
that's the pass, I'm bored.
That's the pass, let's just shake things up a little
bit. I'm going to keep adding rules.
So like, for example, like one of the eternals means that certain numbers of cards just can't be played. Mm. One of them means that you must play rare cards if you have them in your hands. So you can force someone else to play something nasty. Or one of them, the dragon, means you must pass your entire hand to another player. And actually, I've messed up a little bit there. That's not a continuous eternal. That's one of the instant eternals, which will happen whenever you play a 2 or a 9. Mm. So there's all these different strange powers that then just shake up the very core game of sevens, where you're just playing at these
brutal. A game in which you can say, you know what? I'm actually not going to take my turn, and I'm going to make your next turn to be weirder or harder.
And the thing that's weird about that is that it's the instant eternals, the one, the dragon that lets you kind of swap your whole hand, is one that you know is in that stack, but you don't know where. Mm. And so one of maybe my favorite and also least favorite moments of this game at the same time. Favorite because it was so wild and funny. Least favorite because it just made me lose immediately.
Yep.
Was when I played the 9, triggering an instant eternal, knowing there were 7 of them in the deck. So only one of them had been revealed. Yep. There were 7, and I got the dragon. I had to swap my winning hand with someone else's absolutely bunk hand. This is terrible.
That's dragons. Really terrible. That's dragons.
And that is the very basics of Eternal Sevens, but just like Eternal Decks, there's a kind of ramping complexity where you can play increasingly more complex modes of the same game.
Mm-hmm.
So the next mode that gets introduced gives all the players unique pass mechanics. So rather than you having those 3 passes that I talked about earlier, you also have these extra passes, one that would let you place a must-play token, which forces someone to play the card into that spot.
I'm overwhelmed.
Yeah, you're overwhelmed.
Honestly, like, I already thought that there being 3 different things you can do in your pass was already like, that's okay.
Yeah, mate,
like, more than 2 is
gonna
little
get even crazier.
Okay.
Because there's that, which adds new passes. Then there's another version you can play, which gets rid of those instant and continuous eternals and replaces them with a dragon that has
another
3
dragon?
Bits of its body that you move cubes down, and as you move the cubes down, it kind of adds in those weird little like rules variants from the continuous eternals I talked about earlier.
I'm just going to put this out here and say that, and it's controversial, but like, I think that like
these card games have gone too far.
I think these dragons are a problem, and I think it's good that we poach them. I think it's good that they poach them.
Good that we poach them back in Emberheart, yeah. That mode also introduces each player having their own unique scoring condition for how they can succeed. So one of the players needs to use up all of their pass tokens, then they get extra points. One of the players needs to not use their pass tokens. One of the players needs to hold specifically blue cards in their hand
at the end of the round. I'm going to use my vibes binocular here and say that like the Eternal Decks was a game that became increasingly convoluted and complicated, and you thought it was
Matt,
wonderful.
The last one
it.
You get to play as the monsters.
Right, okay, but Eternal Sevens, I feel like it gets maybe increasingly complicated and you're not really feeling it.
It's tricky because I think Eternal Decks is a sort of wonderful and unique and strange game that I didn't expect that I would like, because the designer's previous work was a game that was literally just called Trick Takers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a game that was kind of an asymmetric trick taker where each individual player had their own special powers, and I just found it entirely too much. It felt like a sort of strange novelty game that I'm sure there's a bunch of strategy there for people who are looking for it.
Yeah.
But for me, it kind of cut against what I like about card games. And I didn't expect to like Eternal Decks because it was from that designer and I expected it to be very similar.
Got it.
I was really wowed by how much I did like it, how fresh it was. And I think that that's because the core system is really, really strong. And then the way it builds on top of it means it's increasingly very rewarding the more you play. Eternal Sevens, I get 2 feelings. Firstly, I don't find Sevens as compelling a core game to build on top of as I did with the core game of Eternal Decks.
Got it.
And also this kind of competitive and slightly nuts form of card game, I find it harkens back to that earlier game that I didn't gel with, that earlier kind of design impulse that I wasn't in love with, versus the new kind of design that was in Eternal Decks, makes sense.
Got it.
So I guess what I'm saying is that my response to Eternal Sevens was I think I was a little lukewarm on it. I think I struggled to hold on to the strategy over those few games that I played. I think that the third iteration of the game is kind of the real game.
Right.
The first 2 are beginner scenarios that are a little random and a little swingy and a little weird, and I don't think they show it off at its best. But at the same time, I can really see some people who liked that previous bit of design really gelling with this game.
Yeah.
I think that if you're a big Eternal Decks fan and that's it, then don't expect maybe the same magic from Eternal Sevens.
Okay.
But if you're a fan of his previous work, I think you'd probably really enjoy this.
Or if you love the game Sevens.
Or if you just love the game Sevens, which I think is where it comes from.
Right, yeah.
I think it comes from an earnest love of playing Sevens when he was a kid, and then he's made this kind of like bonkers, extravagant version of it that didn't quite click with me, but I can see some people really enjoying it.
Well, there we go.
There's my kind of slightly tepid take on Eternal Sevens, slightly rambly.
And if you're interested, then like find a person on Board Game Geek, meet them in an alleyway, slip them a £20 crisp euro, 20 notes, and then maybe you'll get a game.
And then, quid's in for you.
Mm.
Yeah, very. It's an odd game. Don't know quite how I feel about it after just playing it the other night. Maybe I'll play it again and have more thoughts.
Who knows?
Who knows? That's Eternal Sevens.
Thank you for listening and to listening to the podcast. So, Tom, that brings us to the end of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast.
Which I could tell from the jingle that we do every
time. Yep, that's the classic every time jingle.
Thank you for the podcast. And
the podcast about board games.
So, I'm sure that the next episode of the podcast will definitely be episode 300 of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, in which something very special will happen. So I'm looking forward to that next time, because that's definitely going to be what happens.
That is what's going to happen next episode. We've got it in the calendar. It's happening.
Fantastic.
There will be a special episode 300 next time for sure.
Great.
Great.
See you then. Bye.
Bye.